It's a privilege to be here this morning to offer this seminar on social justice. And we have two distinguished panelists joining me today. They're both on the faculty of Welch College. We have Matt Bracey, who is our Vice Provost for Academic Administration, and also the Assistant Professor of Theology and Culture at Welch College. And he is very prepared and well qualified to speak on this topic. He's done a lot of studies in it. And his bachelor's degree is from Welch in history, and he got a Master of Theological Studies from Beeson Divinity School right here in Birmingham, and his JD, his Doctor of Jurisprudence here at Samford University Law School here in Birmingham. And now he's just about to finish up his PhD on the great conservative thinker Edmund Burke. And that PhD dissertation is being written at Southern Seminary up in Louisville in a public theology PhD that he's in up there. And it's also good to have Philip Morgan, who is an instructor in history and also the head of our history program at Welch College. And he is a wonderful person to listen to and to talk to, and he's easy to talk to about history. He's not one of these people that, you know, gets up and gives boring history lectures. He really gets into it and he loves it. And we're very happy to have him on the faculty of Welch. But he also has an interest in political theology and public justice and the history of political thought and political theory. And so I thought he would be a great person to join me on this panel. He has a bachelor's degree from Welch in music with a major in organ performance at Welch. And he has a master's degree in history from Middle Tennessee State University. And he is completing his dissertation at Kansas State University in history, a PhD dissertation. What's your topic, Phil?
It's on Booker T. Washington.
He's writing on Booker T. Washington. And so he's doing a great job with that. And we're excited to have him as a part of this panel as well. Social justice has been a topic that we've heard a lot about the last few years, and we want to address it from the vantage point of the Christian worldview and the Western tradition, which has been so profoundly informed by the Judeo-Christian account of things. And so I'm going to begin with a few comments, and I'll talk about 5 or 10 minutes, and then they'll each talk 5 or 10 minutes. And then we're going to have a time of just discussion and questions. And you can ask questions or make comments for us to respond to, or however you want to do this, because this is a time of conversation about social justice and some ideas about how we can be about responding to our world in a competent Christian way and also in a way that is kind and loving. I'll never forget when I landed in New Haven, Connecticut, as a graduate student at Yale 30 years ago. Can't believe it's been 30 years. I was introduced to John Rawls's 1971 book, A Theory of Justice, as the quintessential book for understanding social justice. And I'll just tell you, things that were stock and trade at Yale 30 years ago are now discussed nightly on the major news networks. John Rawls's view of justice is summed up in the title of an article he wrote in 1985, entitled Justice as Fairness. This led Rawls to discuss what many have called fair equality of opportunity, sometimes called substantive equality of opportunity. And that fair equality of opportunity, that substantive equality of opportunity, is contrasted or distinguished from what most people mean by equality of opportunity. And what most people mean, especially conservatives, when they say equality of opportunity, is often dubbed formal equality of opportunity. So you have Rawls saying we redefine justice as fairness, and so that is fair equality of opportunity, and then you have formal equality of opportunity. You also have fair equality of opportunity, often dubbed substantive equality of opportunity. Now, formal equality of opportunity says that people's basic attributes, like the socioeconomic setting they're born into or the color of their skin, those basic attributes shouldn't get in the way of their having the same economic opportunities as other people if they have the skill, talent, and moral rectitude. Yet fair equality of opportunity says that it's unjust for some people to be rich while others are poor. In graduate school 30 years ago, Rawls's theory was beginning to be used to discuss other sorts of fairness. This included, for example, the notion that justice requires those from underrepresented groups to be given special advantages, say in admission to universities, even if they don't meet those requirements. Or, for justice to be done, homosexual individuals should have the right to marry just as heterosexuals do. So Rawls's concept of distributive justice, what he called distributive justice, has spilled over from economics into discussions surrounding critical race theory, gay rights, and on and on. And these guys will have some things to talk about regarding that a little bit later. So John Rawls, the quintessential author that set us in motion, in my opinion, on how we as a society are starting to discuss social justice. But when we look at Holy Scripture and the Jewish and Christian traditions, one doesn't see this kind of theory of justice. Those traditions uniformly define justice as giving each individual his due, what's rightfully his. That's how traditional Judeo-Christian theory defines justice. So what does this mean? Well, look at it this way. If everybody kept the Ten Commandments, there would be no injustice in the world. Okay? Think of it that way. If everyone kept the Ten Commandments that are written on our hearts, there would be no injustice in the world. So, let's look at those Ten Commandments, the second table especially, and think about that. So if we deprive people of religious liberty, or if we take their lives, or steal their property, including their own liberty, which is happening every day with human trafficking, if we do these things, we're not giving them what God thinks is due them, what is rightfully theirs. If our contractual relationships are based on lies and deception, we're not giving people their due. You know, fraudulent contractual relationships. When individuals covet other people's property or a sexual relationship with their spouse, they predispose themselves to deprive people of what's rightfully theirs. So we need to get back to the way the Jewish and Christian traditions think of this, and think of it in terms of God's law. And if everyone obeyed God's law, then everyone would be treated justly. There would be no injustice. So how do we right the wrongs of this world? How do we make just the injustices of this world? Is to go back to the law of God. But one should not be deprived of what is due them, of what is rightfully theirs because of the color of their skin, for example. So there are certain innate characteristics that God creates people in that should not deprive them of what is their due as individuals. Now, I used to think that because of the diverse ways the term social justice has been used historically, it was a useful term. But the young folks talked me out of that. You know, sometimes we elders need to listen to the young folks because they have wisdom. And so a lot of my younger intellectual colleagues have talked me out of using the term social justice, which I thought was a useful term. I thought, why let the secular progressives have such a great term? I mean, you know, societal justice. We all believe in justice. We all believe in being social. So why not try to preserve this term? But I began to see how that many of my theologically conservative friends who were using the term social justice a lot, and they're dear friends and I love them, but when they used the term social justice, they were always talking about poverty or racism. Now, my conservative theological friends were not talking about the LGBT cause. But they were usually talking about poverty and racism. And of course, they were right to be concerned about poverty and racism. But that's the only time they used the term social justice. They would never use the term
when talking about things like the injustice of abortion, which deprives human individuals of what's theirs by divine right, their lives. They'd never use the term social justice when talking about the injustice of no-fault divorce. In fact, they never talked about no-fault divorce. They just assumed it and assumed that's the new normal. That's what we have to live with. And of course, no-fault divorce is unjust and it's social because it affects a lot of children and a lot of individuals. It encourages married couples to engage in unjust actions, and it is unjust to the children of divorce. They didn't talk about the injustice of allowing activist physicians to prey on young women who have psychological difficulties and wish to attempt to transition to appear as a male. That's unjust. That ought not to be. It hurts people. It is unjust. But the people that I kept hearing talking about social justice, social justice, social justice in my conservative evangelical community were not talking about these other injustices. They were only talking about the things that CNN and the major news networks were dubbing socially unjust. We've got to be very careful that we are not like the frog in the kettle, and that the trends and fads of the spirit of our present age do not slowly cook us, that we just don't kind of be unaware. We need to be critical thinkers. We need to be loving and kind and engaging, but we need to be critical thinkers about this stuff. I've also noticed in recent years that most of the talk of social justice, even among Christians, is gradually, maybe unwittingly, being tied to Rawlsian theories. I talked about John Rawls a minute ago. And these theories are poles apart from the Bible and the Hebrew and Christian traditions. And they're poles apart even from classical theories of justice associated with Plato or Aristotle or Cicero. So it has started seeming to this old boy that the language of social justice has become well nigh useless for we who are conservatives and who are Christians. We need to think clearly when we quote Bible verses with motifs like justice flowing down like the river. We need to make certain that we don't allow our biblical concept of justice to be co-opted by Rawlsian distributive justice understandings just because we hear those theories repeated over and over and over. We must understand that those theories of justice are foreign to the Old and New Testaments, and they're foreign to thousands of years of Jewish and Christian reflection on them. Now let me stress here, in avoiding these unbiblical accounts of justice, we must even more consistently and heartily advocate for compassion and love and charity and helping the poor and giving people opportunities to get out of poverty. Not just giving lip service, but dedicating ourselves and our churches to finding ways to help people in poverty while holding a biblical view of justice, a view of justice that is not divorced from the Bible and the Christian tradition. We've got to double down on that. Sometimes we have a tendency to, it's like we're either here or here. And we think that if we're conservative and we have traditional Christian theories of justice, that we don't care for the poor. We don't care about these matters. We've got to bring it back together like Jesus and Paul and like Anselm and Augustine and Luther and Calvin and Wesley. We've got to bring them back together. That our social concern, our compassion for the hurting, come together with a genuinely Christian understanding of justice. For example, we must advocate for everyone having equal treatment under the law, regardless of their skin color. We must pray for grace and conviction and seek to be consistent with biblical principles and thus seek harmony and reconciliation with people of other ethnicities than our own. We must treat people made in God's image with dignity and respect. We must let the world know how wrong it is to treat people unjustly because of their ethnicity or skin color. But in consistently embodying this Christian charity and in fostering it in those around us and in our churches and schools, we've got to be careful not to allow our thinking to drift in a direction of Rawlsian social justice, which is at odds with the Christian religion. Now I'm going to turn it over to Matt Bracey. Let's welcome him to the podium.
Thank you. That evangelical from the 20th century referred to conservative Christians doing justice. He referred to it as Christian social ethics. That was his term. Social justice advocates often speak of equality and increasingly equity. These are these buzzwords. So over the next 5 to 7 minutes, I'm going to talk about these two buzzwords. Let's begin with some definitions. At root, equality refers to the condition of being equal or the condition of just sameness, the same, whether with respect to status or rights or opportunities and or results. So depending on who's talking about it, it could be any of those things. And by the way, an equality of status versus an equality of results are very, very different things. So there's a lot that comes under the nomenclature of equality. Equity is at root related to the word equality. It means equal, but it generally refers classically to the quality of being fair or impartial. In fact, if you look to many translations of the Bible, if you look to the Proverbs, Solomon uses the word equity, at least in our translations. So despite what it's come to mean today, at times, it's a good biblical word. But the issue concerns what type of equality or equity are we talking about? Also, who's defining words like fairness? Fairness according to whom? So let's look to see how social justice advocates emphasize these words. I'll give some examples and then we'll turn to biblical justice. Social justice advocates emphasize often an equality of rights, opportunities, and even outcomes with respect to ethnicity, sex, socioeconomic status, and more. However, I will argue that equality in these areas may or may not comport with biblical justice, depending on what precisely we're talking about. For example, the organization Black Lives Matter defines itself as, quote, one of the largest social justice movements in history. And it has, Black Lives Matter has strongly condemned inequalities that have resulted toward black women from the recent Dobbs decision, the decision that overturned Roe and Casey and returned the issue of abortion to the states. BLM, in fact, argues in favor of what it calls reproductive rights. And it denounces, quote, the inequality of opportunities that we have to control our reproductive destiny. So there you've got the language of rights and the language of opportunities baked into this concept of reproductive rights and opportunities about reproduction. Similarly, social justice advocates have denounced inequality surrounding people who identify themselves as LGBTQ, as well as marriage. Consequently, social justice advocates support the so-called Equality Act, as well as the same-sex marriage bill, both of which BLM supports, by the way. The Equality Act, for those of you who may be wondering, some of you have heard of this, I gave a seminar on it last year, the Equality Act would redefine the word sex in the Civil Rights Act to include LGBTQ, as well as what's called SOGI, sexual orientation, gender identity. The same-sex marriage bill is a rather recent bill that would codify marriage to encompass persons of the same sex legislatively on the federal level. A third example of equality and the way that social justice advocates use it concerns socioeconomic equality or equity. For example, there's a United Nations publication called Social Justice in an Open World. And it argues that social justice requires that a country have a strong and coherent redistributivist policy conceived and implemented by public agencies. I'll repeat that. A country, if it's going to practice social justice, must have strong and coherent redistributive policies conceived and implemented by public agencies. What's this talking about? A strong centralized government with the authority to redistribute income as it sees fit. That's according to the United Nations publication, Social Justice in an Open World. In the words of economist Thomas Sowell, who is not sympathetic to this view, he says, can we just say magic words like social justice and start confiscating? Biblical justice. How does the Bible look at these concepts? Biblical justice, I believe, also highlights equality and equity, but not in the same manner as social justice advocates. For example, all human beings have equal dignity and moral worth because they're divine image bearers. All persons, all people are made in God's image, according to God's likeness. Distinctions in biological sex, ethnicity, nationality, socioeconomic status, and status of birth, by the way, whether you're still in the womb or outside of the womb, do not remove the inherent equality that they possess before God. Galatians 3:26-28. This principle, writers have said through the years, everyone from Russell Kirk to Abraham Kuyper, this principle means that all people deserve impartiality within the church, and we see this talked about in James chapter 2, and that they warrant due process before the law. President Pinson referenced this just earlier. The law should not treat people differently based on, say, the color of their skin or their socioeconomic status or what have you. All people have equality before God, the church, and the law. Even so, we all have natural inequalities, or what we might call natural differences. Remember, at root, the word equal means the same, but none of us are the same. We're taller and shorter and so on and so forth. We all differ in terms of our characteristics and personalities and abilities and interests and gifts. For example, differences in height means that some people will have a greater opportunity to play basketball than others. Me, not so much. There is not an equality of opportunity here, and that's just the way it is according to nature, according to the way God made me. And that's not unjust. Consequently, inequality of opportunity may or may not be unjust, depending on the issue we're talking about. Height, not an injustice. In fact, the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 12, believed that our natural differences are good because we all play unique roles within a given community. So he talks about the church as a body. And some, you know, different people perform different roles. C.S. Lewis, commenting on this passage, said, it's within the church that we find our inequalities, and we get rid of the artificial equality that society would give us. And this is a good thing because we're different and God made us to be that way. Concerning rights, the language of rights, we may have equal rights with respect to what God has embedded in the created order and communicated through good traditions. President Pinson talked about this with reference to the second table of the law. But we don't have equal rights to disorders such as abortion, same-sex unions, and so forth. These nuances remind us that we have to be mindful that not all rights talk is equally valid. Now, I do believe that there are rights that God has given us, but just because somebody out there in society says something is a right doesn't mean that it in fact is a right. Depends on what we're talking about. In addition, biblical justice supports equity, equality, when it refers to the quality of being fair and impartial with respect to, say, orphans and widows and outcasts and prisoners. These are things that the Bible talks about in terms of how the law treats them. But it does not support equity as meaning equal outcomes. The student who earns a grade of F does not deserve a grade of A. The student who earns a grade of A does not deserve the grade of F. To give them the same result, say a grade of C, irrespective of their natural abilities or their personal study habits, would not be just. It would be actually unjust. Similarly, the hardworking employee may rightly receive greater compensation than the lazy employee. Proverbs 12, 2 Thessalonians 3. In other words, biblical justice recognizes that we humans all have free will. Imagine, free agency, free choice. So, in conclusion to my remarks, the scriptures do not conflate equality with justice or inequality with injustice. Sometimes they overlap, sometimes they don't. By contrast, social justice advocates often conflate these terms in a manner that directly contradicts the scriptures. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Philip Morgan.
President Pinson and Mr. Bracey have given some abstract instruction about the nature of social justice and equality. I'm going to take just a moment to give us a real practical application of when people are pursuing social justice goals, claiming that they're pursuing equality, and how that can actually produce injustice. And I'm actually going to give you two examples. One I'm just going to touch on briefly because you're very familiar, I would assume, with the facts in this particular case because it's going on right now, but that deals with Leah Thomas, the transgender biological male who is swimming against biological females in the college level and winning lots of those meets, as you would expect. And that is, if we want to say, be as charitable as possible to those who advocate for Leah's right to swim against biological females, that they feel that that would be unjust to Leah to deny the self-identity as a woman. If we're being as charitable as possible to say that that's their motive, what they don't seem to be taking into account is how that is unjust to the females that are competing against Leah, and that there are lots of young women who have trained and practiced all their lives and now are facing an unfair competitor because biologically there are differences. And so I think that one's pretty familiar with you, where there's an equality goal. And I think that there are many people who support this that actually are, they believe that they're producing equality, while there may be others who have more malevolent goals. But I think that many really do believe that that's what is most fair. And I think that they're wrong. I think that it produces injustice for those female swimmers. Another example that might be less familiar, particularly to those that are under 50 perhaps, is the Equal Rights Amendment that Betty Friedan started pushing for in the 1960s and 1970s. Betty Friedan is the famous leader of second wave feminism in the United States. And it was inspired by her 1963 book, The Feminine Mystique, where Friedan argued that gender roles, traditional gender roles, particularly as it applied to women, being caretakers over the home, caring for children, that that was an outdated, socially constructed model that needed to be broken away from, and that women needed to be liberated so that they could go into the workforce and be just like men. Now, we should say that Friedan had a very bad marriage, and there were many women who were in very bad marriages in the 1950s. And maybe they had cause to have some complaint. Perhaps Friedan particularly did. That doesn't mean that her solution was necessarily just. Anyway, she was particularly important for pushing the proposed constitutional amendment known as the Equal Rights Amendment that would have restructured women's status in American society in many ways. The Equal Rights Amendment, which did not pass, just barely, and we can thank primarily the Roman Catholic woman Phyllis Schlafly for that. She played a big role in that. She saw Friedan's work for what it was. And the Equal Rights Amendment proposed that women be treated exactly the same as men when it came to legal matters, particularly the Constitution, but it would have been a national legislation because it would have been an amendment to the Constitution. Every state would have had to treat women exactly the same as men legally. And by the way, we might think, of course, why wouldn't we want women to be treated the exact same? Because that's the problem with this. The words are slippery and they sound good, But when we dig into what that actually means, all of a sudden we say, actually, maybe that's not what we want. Maybe we want women to receive fair treatment from the law, but maybe not exactly the same as men, because it turns out that we're different. And we have different roles to play within society, and especially within the family. So, Phyllis Schlafly really met this charge well. So there's a number of things that Schlafly points out and that are true about the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, it did not pass. What we should note is that pieces of this legislation have since been passed pretty much across the United States. And President Pinson mentioned some of those. Those are things that we need to keep in our focus and not let go, like we do with Roe versus Wade. We didn't let that just slide by us. All right, so number one is that if you're in treatment of women exactly the same, then the military draft for combat would apply to women as it does to men. All men, when I was 17 and a half in high school, I had to sign my card. That meant that I was legally could be drafted by the United States government and I could go into combat against my will. If we're going to treat men and women exactly the same, that means that my sisters, my daughters, would have the exact same thing happen to them. And traditionally, women have not gone into combat. Some rare exceptions exist where women volunteered. That's a whole different matter. Maybe still not wise, but they volunteered. It's a whole other thing to draft women as a block into combat. Equal treatment would also mean that there were lots of state laws at this time, when she was working for the Equal Rights Amendment, that required husbands to provide for their families. They had a financial duty responsibility. They wanted to get rid of that because it was unequal treatment. That women should be treated exactly the same. And she had an ulterior motive, which I'll get to in just a moment, for pursuing that. The last one, and the most really destructive in many ways, was no-fault divorce. Prior to the passage of no-fault divorce laws, men and women were treated differently in a divorce settlement. And it was a recognition that women sacrifice time, years of their lives, caring for their children and working within the home, that doesn't show up on a application, a resume for a job, and they don't have the savings from having worked those years. So if you have a traditional society where men and women have those traditional roles, women are adversely hurt significantly during a divorce, especially if there are children in the home. So the old divorce laws recognized that and gave weight to women. They could expect if their husband couldn't prove that they had acted poorly in the marriage, then they could expect to get alimony. They would receive financial support from their ex-husband over time. They would also not split the savings equally. More would go to the wife because she had extra expectations with children and she had less earning potential. No-fault divorces say we're going to treat men and women exactly the same. We'll not take any of that into account. And you don't have to prove cause. You can just leave the marriage whenever you want. Well, lots of men took advantage of that. And they left women with children, without adequate employment to provide for those children. It's a terrible situation. Now, Friedan knew that that was the case. She knew that was the case also with the laws that required a husband to pay for their to provide for the families. But she said, women have to be liberated. We need to them stop using the crutch of the family and the crutch of alimony to care for their kids and stay at home. We gotta get them out into the workforce. So we gotta get rid of these laws. That'll force them out. Or at least it'll encourage them to do so. Now, we can say Friedan at least wasn't as radical as, say, Simone de Beauvoir, the French second wave feminist. She said, we should force women out of the home. Friedan said, well, it should still be up to their choice. Like, we want to encourage them strongly, but it should be voluntary. And Beauvoir said, no, we must force them legally. All right, so that's an equal, they're approaching equality, but it has unjust results, especially for women. All right, so that's a historical example that kind of gives you kind of some on-the-ground application of how these social justice policies oftentimes actually produce injustice.